Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this March the 12th on the West Coast, now March the 13th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. Like to welcome all those listening to us on Wind Talkers Radio Network and on BlogTalkRadio.com. Got a great show for you tonight. We're going to be bringing some solutions to the table with tonight's guest. And really, this is going to open up a myriad of opportunities all around the United States and hopefully in other parts of the world, too. So you want to be sure and stay tuned to the show tonight. Now, I understand the music played twice tonight. I guess the musicians couldn't wait to get the party started. And we're here. So we love that theme so much we had to hear it twice, actually. Lots to talk about. The gentleman, Eugene Ehrlich, who had filmed the UFO video. Actually, it's not UFOs. There were flying saucers from the United Galactic Federation flying over Cleveland, Ohio. I'm working on getting him on the show this coming week. I think that'll be rather interesting to hear what he has to say from the viewpoint of a pretty regular individual that knows what he saw, captured it on film, and took it to the media. Now, there must be a reason why mainstream media is willing to show this. It's, as I've already said on a couple of shows, it's rather disappointing that they have to try to debunk it by bringing someone totally unqualified to speak on the matter and put them on camera and actually give that person more time than they gave the individual who shot the video. But that's how they do things. They have to give us a double dose of the propaganda to try to obfuscate the truth. Of course, we recognize it. We're pointing it out again now, tonight, on this show, and we'll continue to do so. But rather than bellyache, we're going to talk about all the creative people out there who have ideas that they'd like to have developed, solutions to problems, solutions to everyday objects that we use to carry out tasks and chores that we do around the home, things that involve energy, alternative energy sources, things that will improve the quality of our life and bring us back to a state of full consciousness instead of this continuous dumbing down. The interesting thing I notice, this is a glaring reality, is that our leaders who like to think of themselves as elite and privileged and smarter than us actually are looking like jackasses more and more every day. The words out of their mouth belie what they are telling us. So we get the double lie. They're highly trained liars, I have to say, because they can go on TV, they can go on camera and be interviewed about events such as Fort Hood. Now they're now trying to promote the idea that this Major Nidal Malik Hassan was an Al-Qaeda sympathizer. He was a terrorist. And they forget that we pointed out that he was a product of Blacksburg, Virginia, the underground base where they do the mind control that generally surfaces at Virginia Tech. We've had three tragedies there. They're describing the Fort Hood event as the only tragedy that we've had. They should be calling it a false flag event because that's what it is. And they've had three incidents involving Virginia Tech. We had the shooting that everyone heard about, a year or so ago. 13 people were killed in that, and it was found out that the shootist was the brother to a CIA agent. and they pretend like these people don't know anybody, that they just arrived in the country and they've been here for years operating as agents. And there was a shooting of two students. One or both were medical students or microbiology students, probably involved in creating viruses and bacteria to go in vaccines. And the third was a woman who was beheaded in the school cafeteria. Not many people heard about that. We mentioned it on the show a few times. Not that we're into the macabre, but this is the kind of thing that's going on in schools. So when we hear these messages from officials in the military or officials in the government trying to keep painting this broad brush of terrorism, this reality, we've got it figured out, and the word is out, and people are waking up. Get that. Please try and understand that. Spend your time doing your job instead of feeding us propaganda, because we're not going to swallow it anymore. Times are a-changing. With that, I'd like to invite tonight's guest on board. He is my weekly guest on Evident Footprints since the show's inception. He is a scientist, inventor, lecturer, teacher, and I must add author, and we're going to talk about the topic that I just mentioned at the top of the show, as well as some solutions. And I'm sure you're going to find this very interesting and inspiring, and a ray of hope, if nothing else. Our good friend, Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don. How are you tonight?
I'm in rare form. What can I say? Rare form.
Well, that's great.
And
so
you,
I'm happy
you.
To be aboard. Oh, I'm fine. I'm happy to be aboard and anxious to address the situation.
Okay. Jim, you deal with professionals a lot in the realm of the scientific world and invention, and you yourself have come up with some really interesting inventions that have saved people a lot of money. You've brought improvement to the delivery systems of power that is used day in and day out by regular people as well as the industrial community, and I suppose the adaptation of those technologies is and the possibilities are just endless, and yet you've been stifled throughout your career in bringing these things out. But you see a shift happening, don't you, in the general demeanor of the inventors and the scientists, even to some extent. Why don't you share some of your feelings about what you see and how that's affecting you?
Well, actually, that's a very interesting request, and I must say it's a two-pronged situation, because even though there are some people that are starting to look at things in a different light, even professional people, as you mentioned, it still staggers me to see how absolutely resistant most people are to any kind of thinking that's outside the box. But as you pointed out in the opening part of the show, we must move ahead. And we have to cater to those individuals who want their consciousness elevated and who have aspirations of their own, and leave the rest of the world to wallow in the muck that they've created. So with that attitude as our main thrust, what I would like to do is to focus on the people like myself and like you and like thousands and thousands of others who really want to bring things out, to address their creative abilities, and to profit from their efforts, I might add. All those things are very important, particularly in a nation that has literally been stripped of all of its creative geniuses, its major facets of industry, and, has succumbed to this horrible state of affairs where everybody just sits around with nothing in particular to do, waiting to be entertained. It's a very gloomy situation. And luckily for me, I've lived long enough to notice the difference between the attitude that prevailed after World War II and the one that we're experiencing now in this stagnant situation. You know, back when I was a boy, ham radio operators were coming out of the woodwork and people were inventing all sorts of things, and amateurs were building everything from rockets to dragsters and all kinds of custom cars and what have you. And it was an amazing time. And it's a shame that all that seems to be going down the tubes. But in answer to your question, we have been approached more and more by people who want to express what they feel is the answer to various problems. And they're besieged by the complexities of getting things done, protecting their intellectual property, raising the capital to do all of this, and they're also concerned about theft of their ideas and secrecy and all these different things. And so with those problems in mind, and incidentally I have faced them since 1967 myself, so I'm very familiar with all of them, we would like to engender a situation to help people that are interested in doing something. And something can be anything. It doesn't matter if you've got a brilliant idea for a new type of power source, or if you're just interested in replacing the old-fashioned toilet paper roll. It doesn't matter. It's the fact that there's creativity and enthusiasm behind your efforts, and that's what we're honoring. So that's my two cents on that, Don.
And I'm flattered that you included my toilet paper dispenser request in there too.
Well, it was still lingering in my mind from earlier today.
Yeah, for the listening audience, we were talking about that, and that's a pet peeve of mine that they can't seem to find a really functional bathroom tissue dispenser, if you want to call it that. And Jim mentioned one particular design that he had seen. I just think it's one of those things that basically reflects how the populace is treated, you know. Pun intended, I guess. and the purpose of this show tonight is to inform people and let them know that if they have ideas and they're not sure how to go about getting it started, they can now talk to Jim Murray. They can talk to Jim Murray's company, and they can get consultation. They can get the help in manufacturing, designing and manufacturing and testing and bringing to market these inventions. And we're going to talk about that. Now, for our listeners, Jim, and for you, I created a page on my website. I'm rebuilding my site, as many listeners know. And I got my sponsors page up. And the first page I put up is yours, which is a rather detailed accounting of what you do, including photographs. Your resume is on there, a letter from your partner, George Hamill. And we've got the photographs of the workshop that you have there, and descriptions of what types of work you can do, and your background. Which is extremely qualified in many, many areas. But certainly, we want to let people know that this doesn't just apply to power systems per se. We've already come up with some ideas of things that we can bring to the marketplace that, are going to be very useful to folks. And you're going to be a part of that as well. So, in the process of bringing this information to the show, in your usual very plain manner, why don't you describe some of these things? And you know, you can start with the name of the company and all of that, certainly.
Well, I'll do better than that. I think it would be worthwhile to just retrogress a little bit and okay. mention how George and I became involved with one another, and also how long the friendship has lasted. And mm-hmm. then from there we can go right into that kind of stuff.
Okay.
I was actually working on a fascinating project called the Helistat project, which was being completed at Lakehurst Naval Air Station in southern New Jersey. And that's the same place where the Hindenburg blew up, by the way. And this was being done by Piasecki Aircraft of Philadelphia. And I was hired as a data acquisition specialist for them. And I took up residence in the little town of Media, Pennsylvania. And I rented a nice apartment that had an enormous spare room. and I'm always traveling and running around, so I didn't have, you know, the normal furniture that people put in their rooms. So I turned it into a laboratory. And in my evening hours, I don't sleep very much, I was in there tinkering with various things as usual. And I was trying to solve a problem that had to do with a branch of calculus known as calculus of variations. We'll have to talk about it on a different show because it's a very involved situation, but it has to do with gravitational gradients. And there's an awful lot of calculus involved. And so I looked into the possibility of buying a software package that helps you with the solution of various differential equations, because some of them are pretty difficult. And then I found out, because at the time the only computers I was using were PLCs. I never had any reason to use a personal computer prior to this time. Then I found out that there's an infinite variety of computers available. And so I started looking for somebody who was an experienced programmer. And I happened to mention this in the laundry room, of all places, while I was doing a load of wash, to this very attractive young lady that happened to be there, and we got talking about this. And she said, "I know exactly who you need." And I couldn't believe that she would even say that, because after all, I was just flirting. But after we finished our chores, she brought me over to the next building and introduced me to George Hamill. And we have been really tight and fast friends ever since. We've worked on an enormous number of projects together, and we've had three different machine shops between us, one in New Jersey, one in Philadelphia, and now the big shop out in Las Vegas. And George's background is primarily from the aircraft and military technical side of things. He's an excellent mechanical engineer. He's a tool and die engineer and a fantastic programmer and a mathematician par excellence. So we made a very good team. And although he has been using the shop for business purposes, primarily he has been focusing on helping me with some of these complex prototypes that we build. And so it has been our dream for quite some time to try to find a way to help other individuals that have projects. You know, a lot of people will go into a machine shop and they're concerned about secrecy, they're concerned about theft and quality of work and all this kind of stuff. And so they have their parts made, one part here, one part there, one part across town, and then they're very surprised when they have so much trouble putting them together. So our approach over the years has been to build an entire prototype in one place, and we respect whoever it is we're helping. We'll sign non-disclosure agreements or contracts of secrecy, whatever is appropriate. And we can help by starting off with an analysis of the potential idea to see if it's worth your investment of how much money it's going to take to build and test the thing. If it looks like it's a good idea and you want to continue, we'll help you with the drawings. We'll help you with getting the parts all made and assembled. And we can even help with mathematical analysis and testing, instrumentation, you name it. So that's our goal. And the reason we're doing this is because of the fact that we keep running into people who come in and are talking about fantastic projects with a little pencil sketch on the back of a napkin or something. And you can tell that they've been thinking about stuff for a long time, but they're not really sure how to proceed. Or they're really bashful about, you know, talking about their idea because they're afraid to be ridiculed. And we're very open-minded and very honest, and we're not afraid to tell you the true evaluation of the thing, whatever it may be, as we see it. But on the other hand, we welcome all those types of inquiries and the opportunity to help other people start to bring out their creations and make something happen with it. And most people fall right into the hands of the government by rushing to the patent office because they feel that they're going to get the most protection for their device, whatever it happens to be. But you have to realize that whole attitude about running to the patent office has been engendered over the years for the sake of herding the public into this funnel in which, while they think they're being legally protected, what's actually happening is they're being scrutinized, and anything that the government sees that they want, they just take. So you're further ahead to develop the thing, whatever it may be, as far as you can, in almost secrecy, and then once you actually have a working device and whatnot, then you can worry about protecting it. Now, that might sound backwards to a lot of people, but the fact of the matter is that with a competent attorney and a good agreement, you're further ahead than you are the other way anyway, because I'm not saying you shouldn't get a patent. What I am saying is don't rush into it. And make sure you've got all kinds of stuff to back up what you're doing and to prove that it's yours before you hand it over to the wolves. And we can help you with that, too, because I've been writing patents since I'm 19, and I've got several of my own, and I've written literally scores of patents for other people. So those are some opening remarks, and Don, let me throw it back to you because I respond better when you question me, I think.
Okay. What comes to mind is Nikola Tesla. They report over 700 patents. He may have easily had over 1,000, maybe even 1,200 patents, and most of them at one point or another were hijacked, including all of his money, and that a man so prolific in invention would be metaphorically raped of his creativity. And what, you know, the man should have died a billionaire, and he was virtually penniless. So it shows, it underscores what I'm saying, underscores what you just said about rushing to that. Certainly, you can protect yourself when you have something in hand to protect. It makes a lot of sense. And that's very wise counsel, I think. I've been through that route myself, knowing that they'll take something that looks like something and they'll base it on looks alone, which is utterly ridiculous. But or not even looks like it, but in some way resembles it, but I'm making a distinction between shape versus specificity, you know, specific parameters, we'll say. Now, for the average person, that's going to come to you, and I'd like to, I think we should talk about this process. Let me say this, as far as qualifications, on my website, and certainly anyone listening on the BBS homepage, I encourage you, if you're going to continue listening to the show and you want to check this out while we talk about this, you can go to my site, open up a new page in your browser, add a second page, and just keep the other page to the side or behind it, however you want to do it. Or you can collapse the page even. That way you can continue listening to the show. Go to my website, directlightproductions.com. When the homepage opens up at the top, click on sponsors. And then you'll see one heading there right now, because I've got to put my old sponsors back up. But I put Jim's up for tonight's show, because this is pretty useful information. You'll see a heading there on the index page of sponsors, Accurate Machine and Tooling Company. Click on that title, and it will open up a page where you will see a letter from George Hamill. Then you will see capabilities and services list, and you'll see pictures of the equipment, and then there are some more details there, as well as contact information and Jim Murray's professional resume in terms of the types of projects that he's worked on or is quite capable of working on. And I assure you, you could add hundreds or thousands of other possibilities to that list. These are just concise focal points on the strengths of Mr. Murray's qualifications. Now, in looking at George's pictures, Jim, I made the remark to you that it became obvious to me that it's so diverse and the equipment is so professional that George could probably replicate his whole workshop with the equipment that he has, if he was so inclined. Would you agree with that?
Well, I have seen George produce stuff that is so off the wall, and it's done with such beauty and such accuracy that it's totally mind-boggling. So for him to duplicate one of his own machines wouldn't be too difficult, except for the casting, because
yeah.
we don't have a forge, pouring shop, but we've got just about everything else.
Yeah, and I'm not saying he would do that. I'm just saying that it's quite obvious that you've got to be pretty skilled to operate this equipment. And most likely, he's got the skill to do that if he wished to do that.
Oh, absolutely! I mean, I've seen him do amazing things. Don't forget, he cut his teeth when he was very young by following an apprenticeship program with a German facility. I think it was a machine shop in Brooklyn. I'm not positive about that, but it was definitely owned by either Dutch or German people, and he went through a five-year apprenticeship when he was very young, and after that he's worked for a whole myriad of interesting companies, building everything from Gatling guns for the Navy to gearboxes for helicopters and turbine blades and stuff like that for, jet aircraft. I mean, he's really got an amazing spectrum of experience, and he's extremely talented. And the thing that's interesting about George is he's a man of many hats. I mean, it just seems that some of the people that are the most talented are always in that category. He can program. He can do incredible mathematical problems. He's a great designer. And one of his expertise, by the way, is dyes. The man is almost superhuman in his ability to conceive and design and build progressive dyes, compound dyes, all kinds of stamping equipment and things like that. So even if someone wanted, for instance, to build a dye for a custom transformer lamination or something, you know, theoretically we could even do that.
Mm-hmm.
So the accuracy is there, the passion is there, quality is definitely there, and many, many years of experience to back it all up.
Yes. And in the case where, let's say, and I may be jumping ahead, but I just want to add to that, that let's say someone comes with an idea, but it's missing a part, or it's missing a component that, or it could be improved by simplifying it, or by using something styled slightly different from what your customer presented to you originally. I presume that you would consult and say, you know, if I were you, I would do this. Consider this. We can see us manufacturing this in a much more reliable fashion in terms of how long it takes to do it and the quality of the work and how long it will last. He's got that creative juice as well.
Not only that, but we've also got a lot of industrial experience, and so a lot between the two of us, we have the ability to sometimes know about things that represent enormous shortcuts and time-saving situations for people who are trying to build things. We had one guy came in with some really elaborate gearing thing. I don't know what it was for, but at any rate, the idea was that it was supposed to turn so much and then stop and do this and do that. And he had figured out a way of doing it, but it was so convoluted and it would have cost so much money. So what we did was we said to him, well, look, you know, not that we want to throw any cold water on this, but there's a thing that's been around since the 1800s called the Geneva Movement that'll do the exact same thing you're trying to do here. And if you incorporate that into your solution, you'll have, you know, a ready-made component that eliminates half of the stuff in your gearing package there.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be cheaper, it'll be more efficient, and it'll cost you less. And, you know, the guy was stunned, but then he was very grateful. So we run into stuff like that quite a bit. And the other thing that we do between the two of us is that we cooperate across the disciplines. So, like, if I feel that it's a mechanical problem that's beyond my abilities, I'll hand it over to George, and if he runs into something that requires instrumentation or electrical solutions or even automation, then he'll turn it back over to me. I had an automation business for quite a few years in the New York and Boston area, and I used to automate ships and workboats, and especially tugboats. Tugboats were my specialty. So I'm familiar with all kinds of industrial controls and programmable logic controllers and all this kind of stuff. So between the two of us, we can build almost anything. And we also work with a really bright electronics guy who has been with me for about 15 years. And he's capable of laying out PC boards and developing circuitry and all that kind of stuff. So there's very few things that we can't do. And if we do run into something we can't do, we'll just tell you.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the average individual out there that's, you know, we could say garage mechanics or garage inventors, basement inventors, people that like to dabble in scientific projects, occasionally one gets a brainstorm. And he's convinced that that a device that he's conceived can go to market and will do very well. It'll be very successful. Maybe based on its simplicity or something, it does something that no one ever thought of, or at least they may have thought of it but never attempted to do it. And this individual is convinced. And he approaches you, let's say, and says, I have this invention that I'd like you to manufacture. What's it going to cost? And your first question is usually going to be, do you have a prototype? Have you made a prototype? And sometimes that individual will say, what's a prototype? So we have all ends of the spectrum, don't we, in terms of invention and the people that have the desire and the intestinal fortitude to get an idea created and manufactured, but they don't know all the steps in the process. So you determine that this individual doesn't have a prototype. Maybe we should explain what a prototype is to the listening audience.
Well, sure, that's not a problem. All it means is the first model of something that embodies whatever the concept is that you're trying to develop. So, like, for instance, you know, Henry Ford's first car, when he finally tinkered it together, would have been the prototype from which the Model T and the Model A and other models eventually evolved. We've helped a lot of people with prototypes over the years. I might add, myself included, George has at least built 30 or 40 prototypes for me. Because the way things really work, and this is something that Tesla was a great advocate of, in your mind, if you've got a really creative and fertile mind, you always see a way to do the most fantastic things. And the more energy that you put into that, the clearer the picture becomes and the more you believe in your vision. The problem is that if you're in an area that you're not all that familiar with, or you haven't worked on that particular embodiment or something related to it in the past, it's not inconceivable that you've left out something in your thinking, because unless you're totally familiar with it, there may be some hidden aspect to it or some scientific point that you're not familiar with, whatever. The point I'm trying to make is that without that additional knowledge, the device may fail. And so what you want to do is first, after you've envisioned it and thought about it for a long time, as I'm sure most inventors and designers do, then you want to reduce the idea to paper and have a set of drawings and as much auxiliary information as you can, like, for instance, type of bearings, types of gears, notes on how it's supposed to function, all this kind of stuff. And then that package would be the first thing we would examine and go over with you. We can make professional drawings for you or have them made if you don't have the wherewithal to do that. And that's a very important step, because while you may be very comfortable sketching on the back of a greasy napkin from your local diner, it makes it very difficult for the people on the other end who are trying to produce your parts to have a clear understanding of what they're trying to make. And that is something that has to exist, because that's an area, believe it or not, where the biggest bone of contention arises between the so-called inventors and the people that are trying to produce something for them. There has to be a total understanding of what the device is, how it's supposed to function, and what the individual parts are. Once you've crossed that bridge, then you set the machinist or the tool and die man free to start making your parts. And a lot of times what happens is, as they start to go together, you'll notice problems, either in the fit or in the functionality or in the range of motion, you know, something that you didn't predict. And then those things need to be remedied. Then you also have to go back and rectify the drawing so that it reflects the true nature of what you're doing. When you're all done, you have a functional device, whatever it may be. You turn the crank and something happens, or you plug it in and something happens. And if you're pleased with that, then you might want to consider upgrading it or scaling it up, because a lot of the things that we work on, my personal little company is called Nonlinear Dynamics, and the reason for that is because a lot of the things I work on are not linear. And just because you make a bigger one doesn't mean it's going to work in the larger size. You run into that a lot. And so you want to make sure you understand the scaling characteristics and the engineering curves that allow you to make bigger ones or smaller ones. And when you have all this information in hand and you thoroughly understand it, that's the time to start to apply for a patent. Because if you do it the other way, and there's true merit in your idea, all somebody has to do is get a copy of the patent applied for, see further down the road than you did, have deeper pockets than you do, and he's going to go ahead and do all those steps to make a better gizmo, and then he will file an improvement patent on that idea and bring it to market before you realize what happened to you. And it's perfectly legal. Well, almost. But anyway, it goes on a lot. So you have to be careful how you do these things.
Okay. Now, in the event, let's say you get to the point where you make a successful prototype. Now, you would, depending on what, of course, the invention is, what you've actually manufactured, you would most likely recommend some testing, wouldn't you, to make some determinations as to how this device is going to perform over a certain period of time?
Absolutely. I mean, testing is vital because it's, and of course, with testing goes instrumentation.
Yes.
And so without those two things, you have nothing to feed back the results to you in a palatable form. A perfect example is, as you know, I've designed and built motors and generators for quite some time, and even in my own situation, don't fool yourself. I've had thousands of failures. That's part of the game. And it's usually because you overlooked something or you didn't understand something or whatever. But you can achieve what you think is a fantastic effect. Let's say it's a new type of motor. All right, it starts up, it runs, it's sitting there spinning, and you're really excited. Well, it's wonderful, and I'm sure that it emotionally it's going to be very gratifying, but scientifically and technically you have to make sure that it also fills the bill. For instance, you wouldn't want to have a motor that pulls 2,500 watts and delivers a quarter horsepower. You know, that wouldn't be good. The only way that you can tell what's happening is not by pinching the shaft and saying, yes, sir, there's torque there. You just try and stop that sucker. That's, you know, you can't write that up as a declaration of any sort that's going to help you sell the thing. You know, pinching the shaft is not acceptable in the technical world as a means of measuring power. So you have to
put... It's certainly acceptable in the political world, though. But go ahead, Jeff.
I'm not going to go there today, Don. But
yeah.
Anyway, so what you want to do is instrument the device and actually gather data. And then you'll be able to say, okay, my input is so much, my output is so much, I have a system efficiency of so much, and here's where the losses are going. And then you can make the decision as to where you stand. Now, a lot of times people come to us and they'll have an idea that's very basic, and all they really want to do is prove to themselves that it's workable. That's called a proof of concept prototype. And it may be the most inefficient thing in the world, but it works. Now the guy wants to take it back and he'll tinker with it and try to improve it for another few months, and then he may come back to you, he may not. That's fine. But the proof of concept prototype is usually the first thing that's done, and then there's various improvements. There's scaling the thing up. There's whatever other changes come to light over the course of the investigation. And sometimes you have to build quite a few prototypes or at least modify the one that you started with several times. But when you finally get it to where you're happy with it, then what you want to do is produce a pre-production prototype. And a pre-production prototype means that you not only have a functional machine of whatever it does built to absolute specifications, but also a complete bundle of engineering information. That means drawings for each part, everything specified in terms of tolerances and strengths and various materials. You want a bill of materials that says what each part is, where it's going to be supplied from, et cetera, et cetera. You want a write-up that describes how the thing works and what it's for and all this kind of stuff. Now you're in the position to go to somebody and say, hey, I'd like to make, you know, 1,000 of these and start selling them. Let's cut a deal. You know, those are the normal steps of development, Don.
Yeah, and of course, having those preliminary prototypes allows that individual to seek outside funding as well if he wants to get a backer that's interested in investing in the technology or in a potential business. Certainly, he's in a much more powerful place in terms of what he can demand having something in hand that works and having gone about it the way you're describing. So you've just described and answered my question. So why should someone come to Accurate Machine and Tooling other than the fact that Jim Murray, who's on this show every week, is part of that?
Well, I think the best answer and the most realistic one is that anybody that wants something done can go to any machine shop anywhere across the country, and I'm sure they'll be treated, you know, with all the reverence that a customer deserves. But if you have something that you feel is unique or that's particularly problematic or that represents a new concept, and you don't just want parts made, you want help developing the concept, you want help in, let's say, producing a mathematical description of what you're doing, or a technical write-up concerning what you're doing. I mean, we do all those things as a team. And so it's a much broader stroke than you would receive in your local corner machine shop. But if you don't need it, that's fine. We're just saying that if it's something you really want and you want to produce a more complex project, and you want it done professionally, then by all means, come see us.
Okay. Well, again, the information is on my website, directlightproductions.com. Anyone's welcome to go there. The information and contact information is there. Certainly, you will do yourself a favor reading Jim's account of his experience in the industrial world as a professional. And as we've talked about on many shows, if you've listened to Jim Murray on Evident Footprints, you've witnessed him selflessly sharing a vast amount of knowledge and experience in many, many areas. And so he brings all that to the table. I often refer to you as the man, the torchbearer of Nikola Tesla. In many ways, you've not been afforded many of those opportunities in terms of becoming infamous in that respect. Yet those who know you, Jim, and I know I've talked to many, many people that have heard of you, that are familiar with your work and know you personally and have worked with you, and they all say the same thing, that you're really a fantastic scientist, an incredible inventor, and a great teacher. So I encourage folks, if you have an idea and you're not sure, you know, Jim's the kind of guy, he'll steer you in the proper direction if it's something that he's not prepared to do. So Will,
yeah,
I'm sure...
that's absolutely true, Don, and it's an important adjunct, too, because if we're not qualified to do it, we'll just tell you that. And a lot of times I do know people who can do a better job for whatever reason, and we will point you in that direction. One other thing, too, that I want to mention, we have been asked so many times over the years, what are you doing with, you know, your first inventions or your earlier stuff or your preliminary investigations, et cetera, et cetera. And fact of the matter is that a lot of the things that we developed years ago were intermediate steps to other technologies. And as a result of that, even though they're very valuable from a teaching point of view, I didn't have any immediate plans for them. And so what we've decided would be an interesting thing to do is to put together a book that shows various devices and gives descriptions of what they're for and how they work and all this kind of stuff. And it will essentially be a disclosure of a certain trend of development that led me to some of the stuff that's really worthwhile. And I've decided to share that. And so once that book is ready, Don, we're gonna sell that book through you. And just so the listeners understand that in there will be an indicator of some sort on which of those earlier devices are actually available for reproduction. So that if somebody wants to tinker with it on their own, and they don't feel that they can make one, again, you can contact us. The information will be in the book, and we'll duplicate it for you, as well as give you a manual to explain what it's supposed to do and how it does it. So that could be an interesting thing for people that are interested in alternative energy solutions, because that's where I've spent most of my life.
Yes, and again, your experience is so diverse and so in-depth in every area that you've worked, you bring a lot to the table. And I'm excited about that, too. We are going to be bringing some products to directlightproductions.com as well, some things that the folks can own. And that's going to happen in hopefully a very short time. So we'll share those things as we go along. Shifting on to another subject, unless you've got anything else you want to say on this topic, I'd like to take our remaining minutes here tonight, Jim, and talk about some interesting things going on in other parts of our solar system.
No, I think I'm pretty well talked out. If there are people with questions, they can phone me, and I'll do my best to answer their questions, so we don't need to take up any more time here, Don.
Okay, so should we say goodnight then? No.
No, I want you to jump into that solar system stuff. It sounds interesting.
Okay. There have been some recent photographs. I don't know if you have seen them, of the sun. And there are two large objects that have been seen around the sun, at least one at a time. They're circular in shape. They've been described as two planets that have appeared suddenly. And I had an interesting conversation with General Jeremiah from the United Galactic Federation a couple of nights ago. And we talked about this. And he asked me what I thought was going on up there. First, if I was aware that anything was going on, and then what I thought was happening. And I said, yeah, I've heard this rumor that there are two planets that have appeared because of the size of these objects that are obscuring the total image of the sun. If you're looking with a telescope that's got appropriate filters, you can see that there's a rather large object that is moving around. It's staying stationary in one area, and as it moves to the west of our perspective of looking at the sun, another one comes around from the opposite side and around to the east and takes the place of the other one. So these two circular, disc-shaped entities, we'll call them, are moving around the sun. And you and I have done a series of shows on the universal energy grids. We're in agreement on the fact that they exist and how they move, especially how they bend light when they come into proximity of the horizon or the planet in general. But our perspective is in terms of the horizon, how we see differences in colors or the size of the moon or the other planets as they move across the sky. And the first thing I said was, those aren't planets. Those are ships. Those are ships. You could say they're motherships. They're certainly the size of motherships. And he asked me how large I thought they were. And I said, well, just off the top of my head, I said, they're at least 1,000 miles across. And he said, well, we actually took a measurement. They're 1,150 miles across. And he was in agreement that those were craft, that they were not planets. And he asked me why I thought they were there, and I said, they're mitigating the amount of energy that is actually occurring in terms of the sun receiving this energy and then transmuting that energy through the rest of the solar system. And basically, he agreed, and he said that they've determined that the sun's poles have actually flipped, which I find to be a very interesting phenomenon, because we get all this disinformation about what's going on in terms of the sun. It's Planet X, it's the Anunnaki, and they don't want us to know. You know, we hear these stories. I'd be interested in your comments, because the spin is in the opposite direction, too.
The spin of what?
Of the sun.
Okay, and what was your question?
Well, my comment, or you know, I'm basically asking you what your thoughts are on this, if you've heard anything about this, and if that's what's really occurring, what do you think is going on at this time?
Well, first of all, I haven't heard anything about it. Second of all, the concept of ships being that big is really interesting. As a matter of fact, it's almost mind-boggling when you stop to consider. I mean, take an aircraft carrier, for instance, which is one of the biggest things we build here on Earth, like the nuclear ship Enterprise, for instance. That's like a city in itself. I mean, it's got like 5,000 or 6,000 men stationed on it, and it's got enormous power capabilities and all sorts of instrumentation and complexities, and yet it isn't really that big when you stop and think about it. Now, to have an artificially created device that's 1,150 miles in diameter, that's breathtaking. I mean, it speaks very loudly for whatever civilization spawned that creation, because not only is it an enormous undertaking, but obviously the thing works or it wouldn't be here. So it's coming from somewhere else, obviously,
mm-hmm.
to investigate our planet and our solar system and our star. And all those are pretty interesting things. Now, as far as the polarity of the sun magnetic field changing, I would have to tell you that, in all honesty, I don't know that much about the magnetic field of the sun, except that it's pretty intense, and the solar flares that are involved, you know, send out these incredibly energetic particles which come to our planet and all the planets in the solar system as a form of solar wind, or, you know, cosmic rays, or whatever you choose to call them. And I actually know a lot more about the magnetic composition of our Earth and the way it behaves. But we could certainly speculate on it. And it's interesting, too, that this is happening in the year 2010, when all of this other unusual stuff is supposed to start happening in just 2 years. So if some of these unbelievable phenomena are occurring on our sun, and we even have enormous, I'll call them scientific cruisers, coming here to study the phenomenon from elsewhere, even though I can't speculate on the details, I would certainly say that perhaps something is up in a very big way, and they know more about it than we do, and we should start to expect to see some kind of either changes or phenomenon that's going to manifest in our world as a result of this. Now, we already know that there's an amazing coupling between the Earth and the Sun in terms of the way these sunspots and solar flares and other types of energetic activities on our star affect the planet, especially in terms of communication. But we must also realize that there are particle fluxes and radiations and possibly even forces that we don't know about that are also emanating from our sun, and they could affect biological entities. They could affect us mentally and spiritually. There's a lot of things that could happen. There's an organization in Texas, and I can't remember the name offhand, but if anybody's interested, I've got it in my notes. And what they have done is they've raised several million dollars and are building a habitat which attempts to mimic the way the Earth was in the antediluvian times. And they got most of their information from the Bible and other ancient documents. And just with the superficial changes alone, in terms of the magnetic intensity in their environment, temperature, the percentage of oxygen, the purity of the water, and all of these things, they have seen incredible changes in life forms. Absolutely off the charts. And I could mention a few of them, but the point is that if they can do that in a laboratory environment just by making changes that they're aware of, what could happen in the environment of our planet if the sun starts to boil off ingredients that we don't know anything about? It's really worth thinking about.
Yes, I think you and I did a show on that almost 3 years ago, if you remember, when my show was quite young. We talked about that group on one of our shows.
Yeah.
We did a whole show on that.
Yeah, I remember it.
Mm-hmm. I just don't remember the name right now, but it was there was certainly a sense of camaraderie between the people that were working on this project. It was just, you know, pure creativity. And
the interesting thing was they raised the money mostly just by asking for donations from people that were turned on by the idea. And it was amazing how far they got. When I was there, it was while I was living in Dallas that I actually went to see this thing. And while I was there, they had the shell of the main chamber just about finished, and they were putting the pressure locks and all this kind of stuff on there, because one of the things that was required was, I forget whether it was 2 or 3-fold increase in atmospheric pressure. And, in order to accomplish that in a large volume, they needed this big steel enclosure. But some of the other experiments that they did were actually outside the enclosure, and they had the most amazing results. Like, for instance, the venom of rattlesnakes that they had in there was suddenly not toxic anymore, and small fish that you can buy in a pet store, were 3 and 4 feet long, and they had them in these huge aquariums. There were other things, too, like, for instance, the, what do they call those little, I guess they're horn toads, the little lizard things that run around. They're only about as big as a chipmunk, and they had some in there that they, I didn't stay to see it, but they claimed that they were growing in size, and their theory was that, you know, if the process was continued indefinitely, you'd wind up with something the size of a triceratops. So there was a lot of stuff going on, and they had already noted changes in the plant life as well. So who knows? I mean, 2012 may be the end of something or the beginning of something or a little age.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate you talking about this. Now, when I'm talking about this, the spinning of the sun, I'm referring to the energy or the magnetic flux, if you want to call that. But there may be, you know, who knows if the sun is actually moving 93 million miles away. It's a bit difficult to get a look at it, but there are amateur astronomers are actually seeing this on the telescope. They're seeing these objects move. And certainly a planet wouldn't be doing that. My sense is that this is something of a universal nature, that this occurs in other solar systems, that it occurs in other galaxies, other constellations, and it's a regular event. I really feel that way, and that these are very, very high beings. These are celestial beings, if you want to say, that were sent here by the Creator, and they do this on a regular basis. And they're basically assisting us. They're mitigating any peaks that might harm us. And I see this actually being the tipping of the scales back into the favor of the light, literally. That's what I see. So if that's any morsel of encouragement for those out there that are pulling their hair out, wondering what's happening to this world, I think you're going to see everything changing. And it's not going to be stopped. Now, in closing here, Jim, I want to take a minute or two before we say goodnight to the listening audience. You and I did a series of shows very recently on the Hadron Collider in Europe. And I asked General Jeremiah if the Federation, the United Galactic Federation, Galaxy of Hendon, that one, had any thoughts on this process of colliding these two opposing streams of atoms at these incredible speeds. And basically, I think they agree with us, I should say, they do agree with us, that if they succeed in colliding this, they could take out all of Europe, if not more. That it would be so catastrophic. So I just want to throw that out there, that we were right on point in our conclusions about how insane this is.
Well, it's an awful way to have to learn about things you don't know about. You know what I mean? It's kind of like playing Russian roulette. I don't know how many people would actually do that, but you only get one chance. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And then by the time you find out, oh, yeah, I got the live cartridge, it's a little late. And that's the same thing with this. I mean, I'm not saying we shouldn't investigate these things, but what I am saying is that there's an intelligent and responsible way to do things. And if you really don't know what's happening, like, for instance, you commented on the possibility of them creating a local black hole. Well, I don't care how much the physicists study black holes that are 10 light years away. It's a heck of a different thing to have one in your backyard. And who knows what it's going to do? So I think that even if they have the theoretical inference that this could happen, that should be enough impetus for the mature mind to put on the brakes and say, you know what, we really don't know what we're doing.
Yeah.
Maybe we should wait. Or maybe we should be more cautious.
I agree. Well, Jim, we're out of time. It's been a fantastic show, as usual, and I'm sure I'll hear a lot from the listeners about this, and you probably will, too. Again, we want to encourage anyone that's got an ounce of creativity, even a speck of creativity, and you think you have an idea for an invention, or you have something that you've been working on, and it's at the stage to where you feel that you could bring it into production, at least a prototype. You want to go to my website, directlightproductions.com, click on the sponsors link, and read up on Accurate Machine and Tooling Company. And we'll be talking about this more. Maybe we can get George on one of our next shows. What do you say?
He's already expressed an interest. He was just tied up tonight because he had a previous engagement, but I think that he would be willing.
Okay, very good. Well, Jim, I want to wish you a great weekend, and thank you for all the hard work you put in today getting me all this information in such an expedient manner, and I'm glad I was able to throw something up on my site, and I'm sure this is going to evolve into many pages as time goes on, because we'll begin reporting some of the projects that are underway once we're in a position to do that, and I think it's going to be exciting for people to see that we can affect the change. We can create a new reality. And that's our God-given right, isn't it?
Well, I've always thought so. And I continue to believe it. So the more the merrier.
All right. Jim, I wish you a great weekend and a good night. And thank you for being on the show. You'll be with us next Friday. And say hello to David and company.
I will, indeed. Thank you so much, Tom.
All right. Folks, that's it. You've been listening to Evident Footprints, and tonight's special guest, Jim Murray, our resident science advisor. Special thanks to Windtalkers Radio Network and blogtalkradio.com for carrying Evident Footprints. Also, want to thank Don Newsom on the sound, Don and Doug Newsom, for making Evident Footprints possible. Most of all, I want to thank you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join us next Monday when our special guest will be Dr. H. Ruat. In the meantime, have a great weekend, and I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.